following episode of The Projection Booth is brought to you by Diabolik DVD. Specializing in horror, cult, and other oddities on DVD and Blu-ray, please visit www.diabolikdvd.com.
Beyond the darkness, beyond the human evolution, is Khan, a genetically superior tyrant. Exiled to a barren planet, banished by a starship commander he is destined to destroy. Left for dead, he has survived.
I'll chase him round the moons of Nibia and round the Antares maelstrom and round perdition's flames before I give him up. There she is. There she is.
Shield's collapsing, Captain. Can you evade their power?
A few shots, son.
Not enough against their shields.
The base is stubborn.
Scotty, I need warp speed in 3 minutes or we're all dead.
I've done far worse than kill you. I've hurt you. And I wish to go on hurting you. I shall leave you as you left me. Marooned for all eternity. Buried alive. Buried alive.
Sean! Sean!
At the end of the universe lies the beginning of vengeance. Star Trek II. The Wrath of Khan.
Welcome to the Projection Booth. I'm Mike White. Beaming in now is Rob St. Mary.
Nanu, Nanu.
Also along for the ride is our old friend Chris Cummins.
Hello, everyone.
This week, we've journeyed into the far reaches of space to discuss Nicholas Meyer's Star Trek, The Wrath of Khan, the sequel to the highly anticipated and, for most, highly disappointing first film in what would become the Star Trek film franchise, kind of set the gold standard by which all subsequent Star Trek films would be judged. And, in my opinion, it hasn't been matched or beaten yet. It's the story of James T. Kirk, once a commander of a starship who has been relegated to a desk job. He's brought out of what amounts to retirement while supervising a training mission aboard his old ship, the USS Enterprise. An enemy from his past, Khan Noonien Singh, has escaped exile and threatens Kirk's estranged family, as well as the sanctity of life, with something called the Genesis Device. I've just broken down Star Trek II, into pretty much its basic form. I've never actually explained it that way. Usually you kind of speak shorthand when you're talking about Star Trek, and you just go, Kirk's on board, and then he's going out, and he meets Khan from Space Seed, and yada, yada, yada. But not everybody is as familiar with Star Trek as they might be otherwise. So, and I think one of those folks might be you, sir, Rob. Tell us, are you a Trekker or are you not a Trekker?
Well, I don't really follow it close. I will tell you that my pedigree when it comes to Star Trek is the fact that my mother used to watch the reruns of the old series. Big fan of that. Big fan of Next Generation in its original run. I used to see quite a bit of that on the TV. And I think I've seen most of the films at some point because just hanging out around my house, my mom was into it. As for myself, it's not something that I followed, although I was part of a group of geeks from work who all got together and went to see the IMAX dome here in Detroit when it was still open at the Science Center on the night that Star Trek, the reboot, the J.J. Abrams film was released a few years ago, and that was quite fun.
So how about you, Chris? What do you consider yourself? Trekker, non-Trekker, Trekkie?
Oh, God, I'm a tremendous Star Trek guy. The funny thing was, like, all growing up and everything, I was all about, you know, sci-fi in general, but mainly things like Star Wars and Hitchhiker's Guide and, like, Red Dwarf, so I kind of avoided Star Trek until I caught an episode in Next Generation during its fifth season, and that sucked me in, and that was kind of the gateway drug into Trek. And from there, it was just like the movies, the original series, Deep Space Nine, and Voyager I watched a little, and then it kind of lost me, and I had no interest in Enterprise. But for me, my favorite of all the Star Trek is Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
What is it about Deep Space Nine that appeals to you more than any of the other stuff?
I think the acting is the best on it with that cast as opposed to all the other casts. But also, it's really a different kind of Star Trek. It kind of is off-putting to hardcore like Gene Roddenberry fans because it really goes against his viewpoint of a utopian future. Because like Deep Space Nine is an outpost at the end of the galaxy where basically goes wrong quite a bit, and throughout the course of the seven seasons, they get involved in a war that kind of makes the characters have to go against Federation principles in order to kind of like save the day. Without getting too into the actual specifics of the show, it just really the acting is the best. I feel the writing is the best of any of the Star Trek shows, thanks to like Ira Stephen Baer, who was the showrunner, who basically dared constantly to kind of play with the notions of what Star Trek could be. And every show that came in its wake with Voyager and Enterprise, it just never kind of reached the heights of Star Trek. It was kind of a deconstruction and a rebirth of Star Trek at the same time. And that's why it really continues to resonate with me.
I think that the ghost of Gene Roddenberry is going to be looming large over this episode because there's a definite divide when it comes to what people feel is kind of the Gene Roddenberry Star Trek and then the post or just non-Roddenberry version. Sure. I would say that putting this kind of in historical context, Wrath of Khan itself, the first Star Trek movie comes out in 1979, Star Trek the Motion Picture. That definitely, to me, I mean, it felt like a recycled episode from the original series to me. You know, the whole thing of the computer that gains too much knowledge. And basically, though he's not officially putting people on trial, it feels like there's this whole judgment of mankind. Sure. And we have to figure out, you know, are humans worthwhile or not? You know, the creator, he can't be you because you are an imperfect being. Carbon-based life forms are imperfect.
The flip side of that is, at this time, you have to really remember that before, there wasn't much of a precedent for there. In fact, there was no precedent for a show being canceled and being revived in the way Star Trek was. I mean, even before the movie, there was the animated series, there was fandom. There's, in these days of reviving shows like Jericho and through fan campaigns and things, like, it's kind of commonplace. But back in the 70s, there was no real reviving a series because of fan outcry. So Star Trek was a real trendsetter in that respect. So the movie comes along, and what the movie does that I feel does right is it does give the TV show just this grand scope. You look at the movie, and I personally feel the movie's beautiful to look at. I feel that the performances are, you know, what I would want out of Shatner and Nimoy and the rest of the cast. But the adventure itself, while it is just kind of a slight rehash of several Star Trek episodes, what I really find rewarding about it is that it is this grand space journey. You are really thrust into outer space with it, that when you see the Enterprise for the first time, it's a very, you know, not to sound silly, but it is a very cinematic reveal of the Enterprise on the big screen. People say it's plodding and it's slow, or the motionless picture, which is the kind of go-to line for the movie. But I really feel that, you know, it does take its time with things, but it takes its time because it had been off the air for so long, and it really wanted to make the most of the transition from the small screen to the big screen. And that's why I feel it kind of succeeds in a lot of ways. I don't really have a problem with the whole V'ger thing. It's kind of cheesy at times, but, you know, it is a product of late 70s sci-fi. So I have a warm spot for it in my heart, just as I do like something like Logan's Run. But I do understand why people don't revisit it.
The motion picture comes out. It does very well amongst fans, but it doesn't necessarily do too much otherwise. So that is 1979, and this is still in a time when sequels aren't necessarily commonplace, but we've got another franchise that is coming out with a sequel the next year. That's The Empire Strikes Back as the sequel to Star Wars. Let's go ahead. Let's make a second Star Trek movie. It takes them 3 years before we get another Star Trek movie, which is, at that point, pretty par for the course. It was 3 years between each one of the Star Wars films. Came to Star Trek II, and they pretty much threw out a lot of stuff, including the budget. I will say that the budget for the second movie was definitely minimized after the first one was kind of a disappointment. But I think the biggest boon for the second movie is that we've kind of got some fresh eyes coming into this and taking over and giving the Star Trek universe a little bit of a kick in the pants. And a lot of people credit Nicholas Meyer for kind of revamping everything, but I think really a lot of the credit goes to Harv Bennett for some of this, because he is, you know, God, he's been around forever. He's done a ton of different TV work. He's done a bunch of movie work, and he just kind of knows what he's doing when it comes to this. The legend is that he goes into the archives and rewatches. He's never seen Star Trek before. Goes in and watches all of the original series and locks on to this Khan character from Space Seed. So there's that story, but then there's also the story that you've got all of these different writers who are given this task of come up with an idea and a script for the next Star Trek movie. And I think somewhere in between all of that is where we get the real story of what happens with Star Trek II. And, you know, I've gone over the plot a little bit, but I think the idea of kind of paying homage to the original series by taking a character from the original series that we have, you know, that basically they said, let's come back and revisit this guy.
Have you ever read Milton, Captain?
Yeah. It is better to rule in hell than serve in heaven. Statement Lucifer made when he fell into the pit.
Would be interesting, Captain, to return to that world in 100 years and learn what crop had sprung from the seed you planted today.
Yes, Mr. Spock, it would indeed.
We're giving the old series proper respect, but yet for me, and I don't know about you guys, but Nicholas Meyer just takes everything and just pushes it into a whole different arena. I mean, we get a whole new spin on, of course, the uniforms, the ranks, the terminology. I mean, so much has been injected into Star Trek II that wasn't present any time before that. And for me, it was just, it came at it from the right angle. So, Rob, I want to talk to you. I mean, you know, you are not necessarily a Trekker, and I think that's great because it's good to have, you know, all these different perspectives on here. What is it about Star Trek II that kind of holds up for you?
Coming to it, and I haven't seen the Star Trek, the motion picture, in probably 15 years or more, is that for me, I could get into it and I already had background. Like, to me, the characters are all sort of built into the American pop culture. So you don't, even if you're even more casual at it than I am, you already know who all these people are. You know what their interplay is. You know Spock and the logic thing. You know Kirk and his way of doing things. You know all this stuff. And that's the thing that I really liked about it, was that we get an opportunity with this film where you see sort of the interactions of the old guard and the new guard, and you have characters like Slavik, Kirstie Alley, which the first thing I thought to myself,
Slavik.
No,
sorry.
See, there you go. That's how much of a Trekker I am. You're going to keep that. I know it. Slavik. All right. So you have characters like her that the first thing I thought when I saw her was, man, Kirstie Alley was smoking back then. But at the same time, they're mixing with the old guard, and there's this sort of exchange of methods, this exchange of ideas that I really like. Of course, the interplay with Ricardo Montalban as Khan. He is in this film. And like I said, I've seen all the films. I haven't watched them religiously. But to me, he epitomizes within the film series, that's the kind of villain you want. That's the kind of guy you want, you know, is that character. That character is so good and so fascinating that it's like every time he falls off the screen, I'm like, when are you bringing him back? I want to hang out with him more.
He's probably my favorite film villain to this day. I think the interesting thing, because we can just sit here all night and just throw accolades at the movie, and I'm sure we will quite a bit more, but the interesting thing to me about this movie is it was make or break time for Star Trek. The first movie came out, and where it did okay, it didn't really get the fan base really juiced, you know, for more Trek. I mean, the hardcore fans did, but mainstream audiences were kind of like, well, that was interesting, but they were disappointed by it. So, you know, with Star Trek II, I think because of the leadership of people like Harve Bennett, they really decided, like, okay, we're just going to go all out here, and we're going to create a new story that is unlike anything that's been seen in Star Trek before. The lightheartedness of the series is gone. The kind of campiness of it is gone. And we're telling a really adult story. We're telling a story that touches on everything, themes of mortality, getting older, you know. There's so much going on thematically within the film. But it was really daring what they tried to do in that they tried to just broaden the Star Trek themes. And they did it in a way that, you know, you don't really feel that there's very much Roddenberry in this film. But you don't really miss it either, because there's so much more mature things. They used Roddenberry's vision of Star Trek and kind of stepped forth and brought it out and expanded it and made it something that still remains the best Star Trek film today, in my opinion, and in most people's opinion.
It was daring to make this film about aging. I mean, to admit to your fan base that these are mortal characters, you know, and to put Jim Kirk into this kind of precarious situation quite a few times. I mean, there is actual danger going on. We get to actually see people dying that have personal relationships with some of our main characters. And so that's, you know, pretty important for this one. And then to take that and you're adding on, and really it's not, it doesn't feel like it's adding on. It feels like it's being integrated into this greater worldwide culture where we've got Dickens and Melville and Shakespeare all kind of being, you know, wound into this thing that we start with the birthday gift to Kirk.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. Message, Spock?
None that I'm conscious of. Except, of course, happy birthday. Surely the best of times.
I mean, this is really intelligent writing that we have going on here. And I know there was intelligent writing on the original series, but I don't think that folks really give enough credit to just, you know, how well done this was. And then especially when you look at something else where they try to do that kind of stuff and it doesn't work out as well, then you get to really see just how clunky Star Trek II could have been. I mean, there was that line in Star Trek First Contact.
Oh, come on, Captain. You're not the first man to get a thrill from murdering someone.
I see it all the time.
Get out!
Or what? You'll kill me?
I don't have time for this.
Oh, hey, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt your little quest. Captain Ahab has to go hunt his whale.
What?
You do have books in the 24th century.
This is not about revenge.
Liar!
This is about saving the future of humanity!
Jean-Luc, blow up the damn ship!
No! They invade our space, and we fall back. They assimilate entire worlds, and we fall back. Not again. The line must be drawn here. This far, no farther. I will make them pay for what they've done.
See you around, Ahab.
And he piled upon the whale's white hump the sum of all the rage and hate felt by his whole race. If his chest had been a cannon, would have shot his heart upon it.
What?
Moby Dick.
Actually, I never read it.
Wow, you guys just pulled out the Melville card and you have no idea how to use it. I mean, you've got Montalban from Hell's Heart, I Stab at Thee, this amazing scene in Star Trek II, and then you've got, you know, Picard going, oh yeah, I guess I am like Captain Ahab. I mean, I felt bad for for Patrick Stewart in that horrible scene, and it just kind of shows me how great Star Trek II really was.
It wasn't just a good sci-fi film. It was a good film. And it can really go toe-to-toe with any other, you know, what's considered important films of 1982, as far as I'm concerned, in terms of content.
What are your feelings on Star Trek VI?
Ah, man, I don't really have too many good things to say about Star Trek VI. I think it's really overwrought, and I think I said to you in an email, it's about as subtle as a wet fart in white pants. I just feel like the movie just constantly beats you over the head with what it's trying to say, and look how important we are. And just, it was way too much with the Shakespeare, and I would actually watch 1 in 5 repeatedly before I would watch 6, but I know I'm in the minority.
I was so looking forward to 6 as being this kind of redemptive moment, because for folks listening at home, you've got Star Trek 2, which to me is, you know, the pinnacle. Star Trek 3 is continuing the same narrative line. There's really not a whole lot of continuity between 1 and 2. They're very much just separate stories. And I would say that 2, 3, and 4 kind of tell this, you know, fairly well encapsulated story. And we've got Nicholas Meyer's presence in 2 and 4 and a little bit in 3. And we've got, you know, Nimoy directing in 3. And so we kind of have this line being carried through. 5, again, completely diverges from where we've been. And then 6, we've kind of got this triumphant return of Nicholas Meyer. I was just so stoked to see this thing, because I was like, great, Meyer's back. He's going to be, you know, he's writing this thing and directing it. And it's, you know, going back and reworking some, you know, political metaphors. This will be terrific. And he just takes that Shakespeare thing, man, and just, you know, oh, it just drives it into the ground. I mean, there's that nice line, just a real quick line in Star Trek II about the old Klingon proverb of revenge being a dish best served cold.
Ah, Kirk, my old friend. Do you know the Klingon proverb that tells us revenge is a dish that is best served cold? It is very cold in space.
And then you get every frickin' Klingon in the entire Federation, or sorry, they're not in the Federation yet, in the entire Klingon Empire, who is quoting just, oh my God. I mean, Christopher Plummer, I mean, come on, you know, put a cork in it, man. It is ridiculous how much he's quoting from Shakespeare. And it's just like, if you met this guy at a dinner party, I mean, it's like, get me away from him. I don't want to be anywhere near this guy. And again, you know, he's supposed to be our main villain. And it was like, really, this guy, you know, he's more of a joke to me than he was any kind of a threat.
There's some moments of kind of misguided comedy in the film that I think do disservice to the character. Uhura on the bridge looking through, you know, books to figure out how to speak Klingon. It's been a while since I've seen it, but I believe that's a gag in the film. But I just, you know, it's there's a lot of like, little like funny moments in it. And I mean, to me, the most interesting thing about Star Trek VI is the rumors that Kim Cattrall got naked on the bridge and commissioned photographs of her sitting in the captain's chair, and apparently Nimoy got very upset about that. That's a rumor that I always heard about the film. I don't know if that's substantiated, but to me, that behind-the-scenes tidbit is way more interesting than anything that's going on screen in that film, because it's just so – there's nothing subtle about it. It's so – you know, here we go, let's have peace in the end, and just, okay, great. The movie is not as smart as, you know, Meyer really wants you to believe it is.
I was just going to say, I don't know anything about Star Trek VI, but Leonard Part VI, that might be what you need to watch instead.
I totally would, Rob, yeah.
I'm a huge fan of Star Trek II, but for me, there's just one major sour note for me in the film, and I don't know if either of you guys even care about this or if it's ever struck you funny, but for me, the one moment in Star Trek II that always bugs me, and I was this close from asking Nicholas Meyer about it, but I didn't, because I didn't want to be one of those fans that's just like, you know, nitpicking every little thing on there. But the one problem I have with Star Trek II is Bones' reaction to Spock when they're talking about what the Genesis Project is.
As a matter of cosmic history, it has always been easier to destroy than to create.
Not anymore. Now we can do both at the same time. According to myth, the Earth was created in 6 days. Now watch out. Here comes Genesis. We'll do it for you in 6 minutes.
Really, Dr. McCoy, you must learn to govern your passions. They will be your undoing. Logic suggests...
Logic? My God, the man's talking about logic. We're talking about universal Armageddon. You're green-blooded and you...
Don't mince words, Bones. What do you really think?
That line where he just goes off on Spock for no reason. They're having a nice civil conversation. And Spock, yes, he's cold and he's logical, but it seems to me that he's just making a point. And man, Bones goes off on this guy. That always just... Oh, it just always hits me wrong.
I totally see what you're saying. It does come out of nowhere, but what I love about that scene is that's so much McCoy's character, is that he is just so hot-tempered. And so when he hears about the Genesis Project, his first thing that comes to his mind is immediately, this is going to be used as a weapon. This is going to seriously fuck some people up. And so he just lashes out, and Spock takes the brunt of it. But yeah, I see what you're saying about that scene. But I'm actually quite a fan of it, because I do think it's it's very much within McCoy's character, and I love Kelly's performance in that scene. I really do.
And the thing that I liked too was this kind of setting up of this next generation, and I don't mean the TV show, but having these younger characters. They were trying to do it a little bit in the first one with Alia and Decker, having these other characters, but for me they were just kind of, a little bit of a foil for the audience, but really just these kind of, really cannon fodder after all. I mean, when we come right down to it. But with the second movie, we've got Savick and we've got David, and so we're kind of introducing what could be, newer, younger characters and everything. And then really, they were almost introduced a character who was very, very young, and I had never known about this until you pointed this out to me, Chris. Can you talk a little bit about the baby that we never see in Star Trek II?
I actually learned about this through a great website, which is called Badass Digest, and the guy who runs that site, this guy, Devin Farisee, is just this huge Star Trek II fan, and the site regularly has great insights about the film. But apparently, there was a scene once at the beginning on SETI Alpha 5 when Chekhov first is down on the planet, where you see apparently a baby in the window on one of the shacks on the planet, and then later in the film, you see this baby crawling towards the Genesis device right before it goes off, and that baby is Khan's son. But no footage of this has ever been found online. Only just one still picture of a baby, on the set from the Genesis Project scene when Genesis goes off towards the end of the film. And I think that's really interesting that they decide to give Khan a baby son, but it's just one of those interesting things about the movie that was cut out. I don't know how crucial to the plot it will be. Well, obviously it wouldn't be crucial to the plot at all, because no one really knows about it. But it is another interesting thing about Khan's character.
And I think it's another kind of play into the whole family idea, too. I mean, there's so much about family in Star Trek II. I mean, Scotty's nephew, Kirk's son, Kirk's kind of wife, not really, old flame kind of thing. The missing mother figure of Martha MacGyver's, the ensign from from Space Seed, who went down to SETI Alpha 5 with Khan and, chose him over the Star Trek crew, the Enterprise crew. There's just all of this great deal of familiar relationships. And I think that's why Joaquin gets mistaken for Khan's son a lot of times, is because we're almost looking for a son character for Khan. And that's kind of the only person really of all of Khan's crew that he interacts with, is this one character who is the only person that has the temerity to kind of second guess Khan.
We're all with you, sir. But consider this. We are free. We have a ship and the means to go where we will. We have escaped permanent exile on SETI Alpha 5. You have proved your superior intellect and defeated the plans of Admiral Kirk. You do not need to defeat him again.
He tasks me. He tasks me, and I shall have him. I'll chase him round the moons of Nibia and round the Antares maelstrom and round perdition's flames before I give him up.
It's great because there is that need for the vengeance that really kind of shows what a poison to the soul revenge can be, and that it's ultimately going to be your undoing.
We're going to take a break, and we'll be back with an interview with Star Trek II director and writer Nicholas Meyer.
And now, a word from our sponsor.
Specializing in horror, cult, and other oddities on DVD and Blu-ray, Diabolik DVD has been owned and operated by the same fine folks for the last 10 years. They proudly feature in-demand titles by companies like Mondo Macabro, Synapse Films, Blue Underground, Arrow UK, Severin, and many others. Get prompt shipping to anywhere around the world and quick replies to your customer service questions. Follow them on Facebook and stop over at DiabolikDVD.com. Because you heard this on the Projection Booth podcast, take 10% off your $75 order today using the coupon code DiabolikDB10. That's DiabolikPB10. Visit DiabolikDVD.com today.
In a world where superheroes patrol every major city.
You didn't get a grappling hook, you got a boat anchor.
Yeah, I know. It was way cheaper, and the only difference is weight tolerance.
Someone has to protect the suburbs.
In the Freedom League of Justice Fighters.
It's kind of a long name.
What?
And it makes it sound like you guys fight justice.
The first two seasons of the Suburban Heroes web series are now available on DVD at suburbanheroes.tv, amazon.com, and via streaming online.
Oh, we should probably stop some crimes at some point.
Suburban Heroes. They're putting the ordinary back in extraordinary.
Yes, we know there's a million podcasts out there, but there's only one Hollywood Outsider. Every week, your hoes, Aaron, Brian, Justin, and Scott, put their own spin on the latest in movie and TV news, new and upcoming releases, topics that are on ours or our listeners' minds, and hell, we even throw in some trivia where you can win a cavalcade of imaginary prizes. Most importantly, we have fun doing it. So come take a listen. Hollywood Outsider is available on iTunes, Zune, Stitcher Radio, or at TheHollywoodOutsider.com.
I didn't know anything about Star Trek. I never used to watch Star Trek. When I was channel surfing, you know, I'd see that guy with the pointy ears, and I just kept going. But I'd been in Hollywood for a while, and I had a childhood friend, a woman named Karen Moore, who was then an executive at Paramount Pictures. I was trying to get my own movie off the ground and not having a lot of success, and she called me up and said, you know, if you want to learn how to be a director, you should go off and direct and not just sit up here holding your breath because you're not getting to make the movie that you want. There's an executive down here who's in charge of the next Star Trek movie, Harv Bennett. I think you would like him, and I think you should come down and talk to him. I probably had my reservations about this and, who knows, expressed some of them. Star Trek, is that the one with the guy with pointy ears, etc.? But she said, you know, don't be such a snob. And so I went down and I met Harv Bennett, and I found that I did like Harv Bennett very, very much. And he showed me the first movie, which I had not seen. And then he showed me some of the Star Trek episodes, notably the episode called Space Seed that had Ricardo Montalban as Khan in it. And he had this sort of idea that he would like to use Khan in a feature film. And I was more intrigued by all of this than I anticipated. For one thing, as I was watching the movie and the episodes, I realized that all of this was tickling something at the back of my memory, something that I really liked, and it probably took me a while to figure out what it was. But I remembered as a kid reading these books by a man named C.S. Forrester, and he wrote a series of novels that greatly appealed to me as a kid. One of them was The African Queen, and the other ones were all about a British sea captain during the Napoleonic Wars, the adventures of Captain Horatio Hornblower. In fact, there was even a movie with Gregory Peck about Captain Hornblower and all his adventures. And I thought about it, and I thought, well, this is just Captain Hornblower in outer space. I bet I could have fun doing that. So he said to me, Harv Bennett, well, we're getting draft 5. I think it was draft 5 they were waiting on for the movie, and we'll send it to you when it comes in, which should be in about a week. And then I looked up, and it was 3 weeks later, and I had not heard from him. I called him up, and I said, well, what happened? Where's this script? And he said, oh, this is rather unfortunate. I can't give you the script. I don't know what to tell you. The script doesn't work. And I said, well, could I see it? And so he sent up draft 5, and it wasn't very good. And I said, well, what about draft 4, draft 3? And he said, well, you don't understand. It's just 5 different scripts. They're not related. They're just an attempt to get a second Star Trek film made, because the first one, with all its flaws, made a lot of money. So I said, well, send up the rest of them. I'd like to read them all, because I was sort of stoked by this point. So I read them, and an idea began to take shape in my mind, and I spoke to Harv Bennett and his producing partner, Robert Salen. I said, well, here's my idea. Why don't we just make a little laundry list from all these 5 scripts of anything that we like? It could be the plot, it could be a subplot, it could be a sequence, it could be a scene, it could be a character, it could be a line of dialogue. I don't care. Let's just make a list. And then I'll try to devise a new screenplay that will encompass all the things that we like. And they didn't seem very taken with my idea, and I said, well, what's wrong with this? And they said, well, the problem is that ILM, which is doing the special effects, that's George Lucas's special effects company, they can't guarantee delivery of the effects shots if they don't have the script in 12 days, I think it was. And I said, oh, well, you know, if I, you know, when I was young and silly, and well, I think I can do this in 12 days, but we got to make the list right now. And I had my little legal pad out. And they said, oh, well, we couldn't even make your deal in 12 days. And I said, well, let's forget about the writing part of the deal. Put that to one side. Because if we'll forget about the deal, we'll forget about the credit, we'll forget about all of that. Because if we don't decide now, according to you, there's not going to be a movie because we won't be in time for ILM, and the picture, as it turned out, was already booked into theaters for, I think it was in June, the following June, which I had no idea this was how Hollywood movies got made. So they thought I was a little crazy, and my agent went a little crazy. But that was basically how I became involved.
When it came to Harv Bennett, was he familiar with the series either, or was he kind of coming to this as a newbie as well?
He was also a newbie. He did something that I didn't do, which is he sat down and watched them from start to finish, the original episodes. And Harv has a very sort of analytic mind, much more so than mine. I got as far as Hornblower, and that was it. But he was the one who said, okay, well, the sort of the big three are Kirk, Spock, and McCoy, and sort of the rest sort of filter in, and all the other stuff that he concluded and stuff like that.
I know with some films, well, usually franchises, people will get together and they'll kind of send out little teams of writers and say, you guys come up with this, you come up with that, you know, and whoever has the best script will win, basically. Was that kind of the way that this was going, or was it one team or one person writing these 5 drafts that had been coming through?
As I understand it, and I don't remember because this is very long ago, but these were 5 screenplays by 5 different writers, is to the best of my recollection. Or maybe there was teams in there, but I don't remember.
So you got to kind of cherry pick what you liked about these.
I did cherry pick it. And I mean, I sat there with Harv and we said, oh, we like, you know, Lieutenant Savick. We like Kirk Finds His Son. We like the Genesis Project. We like bringing back Khan and like that.
Was it just pretty much you sitting down and stitching all this stuff together once you finally said, okay, that's it?
Yes, that was it.
That it's great because there doesn't have that patchwork feel to the script.
No, I don't think it does. It was definitely, you know, by the time I put it through my meat grinder, and most of the dialogue, if not all of it, or just about all of it, is mine. There's a couple of lines that Harv Bennett stuck in, but I think basically it was mine.
So what was your working relationship with Harv? Because it sounds like you kind of got in with him and worked with him through the whole process.
I had a lovely time. I found him to be a really swell collaborator, and we became friends. There was a point at which our agendas diverged because Harv had an overall deal on the lot, and I did not. You know, and he said, listen, you're the squadron leader, but I'm the base commander, and when you're gone, I'll still be here. And so he had... You know, we had different sort of political agendas. My agenda was the movie and nothing more. And his agenda was longer term. And at a certain point, those agendas diverged. But I think everything happened between us in good faith. I was probably intemperate, passionate, and he was probably tactful and discreet.
This is your sophomore film, right?
Yeah, this was after Time After Time.
Basically, you guys took over this franchise, which is just amazing. What was Gene Roddenberry's involvement at this point?
Well, that's really interesting because this goes to sort of, you know, what one thinks happened and then what it turns out what did happen. I used to tell people that Gene Roddenberry didn't have very much involvement and that it was more sort of a formality by this point. He got a screen credit and presumably was paid. But I didn't recall doing more than sort of meeting him and kissing the ring. Some years later, I was at my alma mater, the University of Iowa, and where I've given a lot of my papers. And I was very surprised to find several letters back and forth between me and Gene Roddenberry in which he was complaining about things in the script, and I was digging in my heels and defending how I wanted to do it. And I had no memory. In fact, to some degree, I still have no memory of these exchanges.
Well, I have to ask what kind of stuff he was complaining about.
Oh, gosh. You know, I really don't know. I think he was trying to put his stamp on it and saying, no, this would never have happened, or this is not how these people act. I think it's fair to say that, you know, we had a big conceptual difference. I think what's true about Star Trek is, and I've used this analogy elsewhere, it's a little bit like the Catholic Mass. The words, the text is a given, but the different writers and directors who work on it, or for that matter, composers, put their own music to it. You have to sort of adhere to certain basic rules, a certain set of characters, the way this universe works, but then you can do some rather interesting things. I think what I discovered was that Gene Roddenberry had a vision of the future, or said that he had a vision of the future, which revolved around the notion of human perfectibility, that things were and would continue to get better. On the contrary, I had no such optimistic feelings. It seemed to me that the human race had always been pretty wretched. And aside from some technological innovations and some artistic accomplishments, hadn't really changed very much. We'd added buttons and speed dial and computers and whatever. But we still had wars, and we still had people who were unhappy, either singly or married or whatever. Nothing seemed to be changed. In fact, the proof of this, which I was only too happy to trot out, is that works of art dating from hundreds or thousands of years ago are by no means mysterious to us. We don't have any difficulty weeping at the fate of Oedipus. We don't have any difficulty understanding or crying at the end of Lear. It's all because it's all the same. Nothing has changed. So my vision, as applied to Roddenberry's world, was bound to conflict. It's more evident, I can think of a specific example, in Six. Because in Six, you learn that the crew of the Enterprise is quite racist when it comes to Klingons. They behave as if the Klingons were niggers. And Roddenberry was very, very upset by this. He said that in the future, there wouldn't be this. And I said, and you know this how? I'm sure there were also specific things where I had gotten, you know, certain details wrong. I don't know if he thought, for example, and I'm just making this up, that the Enterprise didn't make a noise. But I was absolutely adamant that the Enterprise had to make a sound. I wanted an engine that you heard all over that ship, a heartbeat, nearer or louder or softer, depending on how far you were from the engine room. I had sailed the Atlantic a bunch of times on ocean liners, and I was intrigued by the sounds of the engines pumping away. You know, maybe in the future they won't make any noise. In space, they shouldn't make any noise. But we always give them noise on the outside, because otherwise they just look like models flying by.
The bridge of the Enterprise in 2 is a lot, it doesn't sound like it did on the TV show, and then even in 6, it kind of, like the Doors sounds are really kind of reintroduced to the sound mix.
You know, I never paid much attention to the TV series, although I, you know, if I'm in a strange hotel room in a strange city and I see them talking in Korean, I'll stop and watch. Clearly on television, and, you know, it was made for peanuts, and they didn't have a lot of money and stuff. But I just thought the more stuff that you can, the more detail you can throw at this, the better. The mix may have been different for the Doors between 2 and 6, but I definitely thought, okay, there should be some sounds, and the ship should make a sound. Because I was always making a hornblower movie, or a submarine movie, or a destroyer movie. And I wanted everything to sort of emphasize that. And, you know, my favorite shot in 2 is probably that whole running out the torpedo scene where you see the things sort of come down and from the sky and these guys pulling up the gratings and stuff. And it's silly anachronism, but it shows you where my heart was at.
How was it working with the actors who had worked together so often before, and you're kind of this new kid on the block?
Well, I think they were used to the whole idea of different directors coming in. They'd been doing that for all the years they were doing the episodes. They had Robert Wise come in. They, you know, there were all these people who had... So they were professionals, and they were supportive and helpful and would sort of tell me when I was putting a foot wrong and so-and-so doesn't talk this way and so forth. So there was definitely a learning curve, but they were very helpful about my learning curve.
You probably have gotten one of the best performances out of William Shatner that I think I've ever seen.
I agree with you. For whatever reason, I think that 2 of his bests are 2 and 6. And I think that, as far as I figure out, I think that Bill gets really good the more you do it. There may be different reasons for that, but one of the reasons I think, and I felt this way on 2, was that I think he sort of comes in with a lot of overlay of stuff, and that as you keep doing it and he becomes tired or bored, he stops acting so much and just starts being, and then it gets better.
There's a lot about family in Star Trek II, Kirk's son, Scotty's nephew. I was always curious, did you ever imagine Khan having children?
I don't know that I did, although he's surrounded by these sort of Hell's Angels, and who knows if one of them isn't his offspring. Didn't know. Never thought it through. It was only 12 days.
You know, I know that Star Trek fans are kind of a different breed. What are some of the most out there critiques that you've gotten over the years for this film?
I think we've been very lucky with Two. Two is not a film that has gotten criticized a lot. People say, oh, Chekhov wasn't aboard the Enterprise when the Khan episode took place. And, you know, I say things like, well, maybe he was, and you just didn't see him, that he was in another part of the ship or something. There's not a lot. Some people say, well, gee, isn't it a shame that Khan doesn't live long enough to see that Kirk gets away? He dies thinking that he's succeeded, which is true. Some people point out, gee, Kirk and Khan never meet in the whole movie. And that's true, too. But I think, by and large, I've never felt any pressing need to defend myself where this movie is concerned.
I'm glad you don't get the, the combination on the safe is wrong or something like that.
Well, it wouldn't much matter to me. I mean, you know, Arthur Conan Doyle once called the landlady Mrs. Turner and not Mrs. Hudson. I don't think he lost any sleep over it.
I know that you kind of had some objections as far as that the denouement with going down to the Genesis planet and all that. What was it like for you as an artist kind of creating Star Trek II and then just kind of leaving it? And it was almost like an exquisite corpse where somebody else came in and wrote three. How do you feel looking at that and seeing the way that they took your story?
Well, in the first place, I was asked to write and direct three. When I said, what's it going to be about, as if I didn't know, I said, gee, I don't think I'd be good at Resurrection. I don't know how to do that. And at the time, when they wanted to sort of open-end the possibilities at the end of two with a view, which they hadn't previously bothered about, to bring Spock back, I had been adamantly opposed to this. Purist and hard-ass that I was, I said, gee, there's a lot of people going to be very upset if we kill this guy, and then it all turns out to be a dry hustle. I thought that was really unforgivable, and I didn't want to be a part of that, so that was sort of done over my dead body, as it were. And I sure as hell wasn't going to be any part of three. With the passage of time, you know, I go, oh, well, who cares, you know, tell Michael it was just business. I get it.
I know that Hornblower was kind of your inspiration for two. When it came to six, other than the political overtones, of course, was there kind of a central inspiration for that as well?
Hornblower definitely was the world that, you know, and certainly there were, politically, there was everything that was going on was the inspiration. In fact, we actually predicted the Soviet coup before it happened, just trying to figure out where things were going in Russia. And we killed Gorkon before Gorbachev was abducted. And I remember we were in the cutting room when it happened, and everybody was just sort of staring and wondering whether this poor man was dead or alive. The other, you know, inspiration, I suppose, was the Manchurian candidate, the whole assassination sequence at the end. But, you know, in terms of inspiration and influence, it's always rather tricky to know to what degree, where do ideas come from? Where are you influenced? Where did you find X, Y, and Z? And does that sound as cool as saying as you found it elsewhere? You know, is it cooler to say you were influenced by Alfred Hitchcock when in fact you were aware of taking more from Sam Fuller? I don't know, because there's an element of self-presentation, mythopoiesis. So, you know, I'm not sure of all the things that influenced me rather than the things I think influenced me or the things I would like to think inspired me. I know that the Manchurian candidate was a deliberate steal. I know that the idea of the wall coming down in outer space was definitely the jumping off point for Six. And in Leonard's idea, who am I if I have no enemy to define me?
When it came to the final decision to change the character from Savik to Valeris, what were your feelings on that? Was that kind of pressure from above, or were you the one that said, you know, let's make this a different person?
We didn't have a choice. It certainly wasn't pressure from above. I'm sure everybody would have loved if Kirstie Alley had brought back Savik. And it would have, I think, been much more poignant to have someone that we were actually fond of and had grown to care about turn out to be prey to this kind of falling angel, however you want to characterize it. But she didn't want to do it. So it wasn't the studio, it wasn't pressure or anything. What I said was I had seen someone else try to play Savik, and that didn't work for me. So I said, I would rather, instead of a third Savik, let's just make another character and start from scratch. I do think my favorite scene in that movie, in many ways, is the scene between Spock and Valeris in his quarters, where they're each sort of talking past each other.
And I probably shouldn't like this, but I do like the mind meld scene as well. Just that we've never seen Spock have to use his abilities the way that he does in that scene.
I find that a very distressing scene to look at now, because basically it's torture. It's torture for information. I'm not sure that I'm pretty sure that you're not supposed to torture people, and we're not supposed to torture people. The United States. I'm not even sure that torture is a reliable way of getting information or a way of getting reliable information. And all of that. So I kind of wince at that moment, and I'm a little embarrassed by it.
What was it like filming with Kim Cattrall? I heard a rumor about her taking some photos on the bridge of the Enterprise that were somewhat inappropriate.
Yeah, she posed for some, how inappropriate were they? I thought they were swell, but Leonard, who was the executive producer, felt they were inappropriate, and so they were killed. I wasn't around for it, more's the pity.
Welcome back to the Projection Booth, where we're talking about Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, with our guest co-host for this week, Chris Cummins of Hibernation Sickness. Chris, when it came to discussing Star Trek II, we've been kind of exchanging emails for a little bit about this. I felt a little bit of reticence from you when it came to the whole Khan in the Star Trek universe. What are your thoughts about the whole sci-fi idea of expanding the mythos via other media?
I think I was really soured to the whole idea of expanding universes when I read Heir to the Empire, and there was like a 4-paragraph thing about Princess Leia drinking hot chocolate, and that really kind of took me right out of the book, and I was like, I'm really not interested in expanding universe stuff. I've gotten into this discussion so many times with people that I'm very much kind of a proponent of, if it's on the screen, I'm interested in it. If it isn't on the screen, or referred to by the characters who are on the screen, in my opinion, it kind of didn't really happen. And, I've heard people explain, plot problems with the Star Wars prequels because of things that, they've explained away plot problems in the Star Wars prequels because of things that happened in novels and things like that. And I just think that's kind of bullshit. So I'm not really a fan at all of expanded universe or, picking up the characters in other media. And I know they've done that quite a bit with Khan, and it just doesn't really interest me too much.
Yeah, they definitely have. There's been a series of 3 books that Greg Cox wrote, The Eugenics Wars, Part 1 and 2, and then Terrain and Hell, kind of, taking that Milton line that Khan had dropped in Space Seed. I mean, I like that Khan was a character from the original series. I think that was so super smart that they did that. And then I almost like that they've kind of worked him into some other areas of the Star Trek universe, as far as I actually bit the bullet and watched 2 episodes of Star Trek Enterprise just because I heard that there were references to Khan in them. And this kind of closes this strange gap for me that I'd always, had kind of gnawing at the back of my head, because we've got Khan Noonien Singh,
is the original name that they give Khan from the original series. And then in Star Trek The Next Generation, we find Data's creator. Data, just for folks who don't know, is a cybernetic organism. And his creator's name is Noonien Soong. And I was like, what is this whole Noonien thing? And Soong versus Song. And one was Noonien with a E-N and the other was A-N. So they tried to close this loop with a character called Arik Soong, who is played by Brent Spiner. And he's all into the whole, you know, eugenics thing that had brought Khan to power and had all these, you know, these genetically superior people out there and yada, yada, yada. And then at the end, it's like, hey, don't feel so bad, Arik. Why don't you go and use your smarts for something else? How about robots as being the perfect being?
I've been thinking, perfecting humanity may not be possible. Cybernetics, artificial life forms. I doubt I'll finish the work myself. Might take a generation or two.
They did actually on Deep Space Nine, one of the characters, the Doctor character, actually turns out to have been genetically enhanced. They do like 3 or 4 episodes that kind of revolve around this. And, you know, they do reference Khan, and the whole problem that he has is he's kept the secret for most of his career because if Starfleet found out, he could potentially be kicked out of Starfleet because, you know, genetically enhanced people once, you know, started the eugenics wars. So that's kind of that is addressed in Deep Space Nine, but it's done in a very subtle way. And I've seen those Enterprise episodes, and yeah, they weren't good.
Yeah, I kind of preferred it a little bit more. Like, in there was an episode where, you know, Picard just in fleeting says,
"What if one of those lives I saved down there is a child who grows up to be the next Adolf Hitler or Khan Singh? Every first year philosophy student has been asked that question since the earliest wormholes were discovered. But this is not a class in temporal logic."
Subtle, exactly.
Even when it came to the whole eugenics war book, they went back and were recycling other characters from the original series universe. We've got the what's the guy's name? Gary Seven and his, you know, magic cat, who is actually an alien who can turn into a person and all this kind of stuff. And it was a little painful reading those two. I had luckily found an audio version of the first one, and they did it very much like a radio play. So we had a lot of sound effects and all this kind of stuff. And that worked a lot better than just trying to read through this thing. And it was all being told as a flashback against another colony where they had used eugenics and, you know, kind of showing what the dangers were. And it was, you know, how did Khan come to be and how is this colony different and all this kind of stuff. But yeah, I cannot recommend any of those expanded universe things, and nor can I recommend going back and watching these Enterprise episodes, because they were pretty painful. I don't know if you guys have kept up. I try not to know anything about, you know, movies that are coming out. I try not to watch previews. I try not to read anything about things because I actually want to be surprised when movies happen. But have you heard anything? Is Benedict Cumberbatch going to be Khan in Star Trek II, the new J.J. Abrams, or is the jury still out on that?
I mean, I think the jury is still out on that. I honestly don't know what they're doing with this movie. I've heard everything from he's Khan to crazy rumors like they're going to somehow start working the Borg into these movies, which is just really, really crazy. So I don't know yet, and I'm actually, like you said, I'm fine with not knowing, just because I was so thrilled with Abrams' reboot that I'm on board for whatever they do. And if Cumberbatch is playing Khan, then I think he'll be a decent Khan, but I don't think it's going to be anything really resembling the Khan that we know, just because, you know, Montalban's Khan is so iconic. I think if they do it, they're going to do it in a way that kind of subverts expectations.
And you also have to ask yourself, would his performance be so good, would you buy a car from him?
I got the Corinthian leather going for me. I know where you're coming from, Rob. The other thing that I love about the film is the use of music. I think that it's got a great score. I love that we've got the Enterprise theme battling it out with Khan's theme, basically. So we have almost this whole story being told musically just as well as it's being told visually. And I don't know if you guys are fans of James Horner, but I thought that the music in Star Trek 2 was just, you know, I mean, the music in Star Trek 1, I will not say anything bad about, because Jerry Goldsmith is amazing. And the soundtrack for that is, you know, so good that they ended up using it again in Star Trek The Next Generation. And I love that. But 2 just really, that's one score that I can put on and it just is so driving and so powerful for me. And I love the use of the nautical themes that he also has going on then there.
I think this is the score in which it's Horner's definitive score, and every subsequent score has kind of been him repeating himself a little bit.
Definitely. Yeah, I was always very amused when it came to Aliens. And I know that he didn't have a whole lot of time, or at least that's his complaint, that he didn't have a whole lot of time to score Aliens. But there's a sequence in there that is just, to me, it's almost identical. And I'll put the two pieces of music side by side, and then folks can judge for themselves whether he was kind of, you know, doing a John Fogerty and plagiarizing himself or not. But yeah, it's pretty identical to me.
You know, the thing that's interesting to me is obviously I've been the quiet man sitting in the corner during much of the discussion, because I'm not as versed in the Star Trek universe. But the one thing I was thinking about as you guys were talking, and you're bringing up all these references to various other things, is that I think I do know more than I actually do, which is funny, because I do remember watching Deep Space Nine. I do remember, you know, these other films that you're referencing and seeing them. But the thing is that I'm not so steeped in it. And for me, it's good to watch, and I would, you know, put people onto it as maybe a good place to start if they just have a passing amount of information on Star Trek. Like I said, I think most people, if you went up to them on the street and said, who's Kirk, who's Spock, who's Sulu, who's, you know, whatever, they can tell you what the relationships are, because this stuff is so much in our pop culture in America, so that it's not like you need to read a book or you have to go back and watch all the seasons of the old show in order to get what the hell's going on in this one. And from my understanding, and like I said, I'm going to plead ignorance because it has been probably 20 years since I saw the first one, that you might not even need to see Star Trek 1 in order to figure out what's going on in Star Trek 2. So it may be the best entry point if you're interested in getting into the films, from what I understand.
You really don't need to go and watch Star Trek 1. This for me was actually the first Star Trek film I saw, and it was actually the first introduction to the original Star Trek characters. I saw this movie before I saw any of the TV shows. I started watching Next Generation, and I felt like I was kind of on the fence about original Trek. So my best friend said, you know, watch Star Trek 2, and I did, and then everything else kind of launched out from there. So yeah, it is, you're absolutely right. It is the perfect kind of starting point, gateway drug for the world of Trek. It is just ultimately an incredibly entertaining film. I mean, all the deep things that are going on within it, it's just, you know, it works on so many levels, and it's great popcorn entertainment. Just as simple as that. So you can enjoy it on multiple levels, and it is the perfect Star Trek film.
We're going to take a break and play a preview from next week's shows.
We've got a lot of folks who are thinking about giving Scrabble tournament play a try. Any advice for the youngsters? You know, there's a lot to be learned from the Scrabble board. Character, you know, courage, stuff like that. And so just go for it. Follow your dreams, regardless of what your friends call you.
What the hell are you doing?
I'm in training.
It's impressive. Oh, can you spell complete f***ing waste of time?
My grandma once told me that my grandpa used to stalk her, but back then it was called courtship.
Uh,
Hardy, did you wash your hair this morning? You look like
How can this be happening? You can't have that lying, cheating, thieving underwear!
Are you out of your mind?
Freedom of speech, man.
Who's in charge here?
Excuse me?
I'm Zoe Rosillo.
Marty Huckdown.
Nice to meet you, Marty Huckdown.
Is she cute?
Yep. A little weird, maybe.
I'll show you what your name spells.
You gotta watch out for the weirdos.
What the hell's that supposed to mean?
I don't know. But Mucky's my new name for you.
Call her, Marty. Jesus wants you to.
Hi.
Hi.
We are diehard word nerds.
I did something today that I've always wanted to do. I entered the National Scrabble Championships.
Is that real?
Realize only one girl has ever won this illustrious competition, yes?
Once you leave this apartment, you will never, ever come back here to me.
Who's the homeless guy? Your boyfriend.
He looks for dirty words all day, too.
You ever kill a man, Marty? I don't know who she is, I don't know where she came from, but she can do it.
Play Scrabble!
Where the hell's Marty?
3 matches till the finals. He'll be here by the end.
I ruined everything.
Pills?
They were my backup plan.
You know the temperature of the water today, Lewis?
You know, if you slip and fall, even in March, you're pretty much dead.
I love you more than anything in this world.
I love you. And need you.
Radio 9000, 9000, officer in trouble.
Trouble? When you got the biggest ripoff of the decade in the murder Police. Capital of the world, you've got more than trouble. You've got disaster. It's gonna get solved, or the town's gonna explode.
There was no police protection. Now, if it'd been a white affair, wouldn't you have had a half dozen cops on duty?
You're gonna take a slug at me and make it good. You understand what I'm saying?
Dan Bassett is the man.
I'll do better than that.
No matter what happens, he loses. Sergeant Jesse Williams used to be an all-pro. Now he's in a different league.
This may sound crazy, but you and I working together, we can make it all fit. Break this thing, Danny.
Another hot flash. Thanks, but no thanks, Sergeant. It's my case. If I need you, I'll ask for your help.
I don't believe you pigs. You're just all alike. You don't believe anybody, do you? I bet you don't even believe each other.
Rovi. Beautiful Rovi. The hooker who couldn't stay out of trouble. Ferdy. The sweet Mac. Ferdy's out after the big score.
Baby, you want to see your sugar man dead, huh? Because that's what I'll be. These guys don't play around.
Detroit 9000, the number that spells trouble.
Go for it, you bastard.
You just heard the previews from QWERTY and Detroit 9000. That's right, bonus show with QWERTY dropping this week and Detroit 9000 on our regularly scheduled time. for Detroit 9000. And not only are you going to get the film, but you're going to get the film reviewed from the very streets and very locations in which Detroit 9000 was shot, right here in the Motor City. We'll be visiting some of those locations where the film was created here over 40 years ago. And before you beam me out of here, I want to say once again thanks to the special guest host this week, Mr. Chris Cummings. Chris, what's going on with your many ventures, something hibernation sickness, topless robot, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, I recently launched hibernationsickness.com, which is just a kind of a catch-all blog for what I'm up to. I also am a regular contributor to toplessrobot.com, geekadelphia.com, and the Tumblr's Know Your Chicken, What's Dave Kendall Wearing, and Songs of 1992, which is all about the songs of 1992. And I do that with my friend Tim.
How can you tell what Dave Kendall is wearing when he's stuck there in the shadows behind Kevin Seal's, you know, immense ego?
Well, that was, once Kevin Seal left, he passed the reins over to Kendall, and MTV was never the same since.
All right. Thanks again, Chris. And thanks to the fine folks out there in Radioland for tuning us in. Now, Rob, please, new course, second star to the right, and straight on till morning.
Chuck, 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 chuck.
Calm.
Chuck, calm.
Chuck, calm.
Chuck, calm.
Shaka Khan.
Let me rock it, Shaka
Khan.
Let me rock it, that's all I wanna do.
Shaka Khan.
Let me rock it, Shaka Khan. Let me rock it, let me feel for you.
Shaka Khan.
What you tell me, what you wanna do? Do you feel for me the way I feel for you?
Shaka Khan.
Let me tell you what I wanna do. I wanna love you, wanna hug you, wanna squeeze you too. But let me take it in my arm, let me feel you with my charm, Shaka. Cause you know that I'm the one to keep you warm, Shaka. I make it more than just a physical dream. I wanna rock you, Shaka, baby, make you wanna scream.
Khan!
Rock it.